I'm amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing FTSE, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing FTSE Show. I'm Steve W. from the Playing FTSE Show, and I've got Steve D. from the Playing FTSE Show with me. Don't adjust your sets, though, viewers, because this is not a better-looking Paul Briscoe with us. It's not, in fact, anyone from the Playing FTSE Show. This is Jamie. Welcome, Jamie. Who are you, and where are you from?
So, hi, I'm Jamie. I'm one half of Stocks and Savings, which is, well, I guess, predominantly an Instagram page, but we've kind of moved into a few different areas of social media. It's a page that I started with my girlfriend about, I'll say, 3 years ago now. Initially, we started it because we were in lockdown. We didn't have an awful lot to do, and we just had to do something to stop ourselves going crazy in a small London flat. So we both had backgrounds in finance. We're both interested in investing. And so we decided to start an Instagram page kind of documenting our investing journey. But after about a year, we realized that there's a lot of interest about investing, but what we were doing, you know, in terms of like analyzing companies, looking at stocks, stuff like that, it felt like maybe 90% of the people that were interested, there need to be some stepping stones in between. So we kind of moved from just focusing on individual companies to kind of like a holistic financial education, you know, helping people understand what's going on in the economy, helping people understand investing, and just trying to make investing and building wealth a lot more accessible and you know, giving an approachable medium to do that. So that's what we've been doing. And now 3 years later, we're doing it full time. And we also have a podcast, tried YouTube for a little bit, that didn't work out. And hopefully we have a newsletter coming out soon. I think we're one of the largest finance-focused UK or UK finance pages on Instagram. So yeah, it's gone better than we expected. So let's just hope for more of the same.
Welcome, congratulations, and thanks. And in that case, we thought we would celebrate this because this is our episode number 130 something. By having a special guest on, and we found Jamie, who should be really good for this kind of thing. But how are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing all right, Steve. Yeah, I've had a pretty sort of bruising week. It's been I've been off work, so I've been trying to get the nursery ready for baby arrival. It was what looks like a white wall until you start painting a white wall and you realise it's kind of yellowy, and you think you're going to get away with one coat, and then you do a second coat. And I've just walked in there now before coming down and thinking, this needs a third cut. So that's what I'll be doing straight after this. I've also got to cut the grass, Steve. So this holiday is just, it's ending on Sunday, obviously back to work on Monday. It's ending in disaster, I think.
Yeah, people are going to start thinking we just cycle through the same old stuff of how's your week been, cut grass, paint walls, do things, trim edges. Join us in 2 weeks' time where we'll discuss cutting Steve's grass again for the fourth time in 2 months.
To be fair with grass, it is something that you have to cut regularly, Steve. I don't know whether you've not had grass or something being in Oxford.
Yeah, we have grass here. We have some quite a lot of grass in Oxford, to be honest. I've cut it once since I got here. And I'm trying to work out whether I want to cut it more often and waste time with this mower that I've got, which is a puny toy of a thing that you recommended I upgrade, or just let it grow and see if it destroys the mower in the process. And if not, so who cares? I needed a better one anyway. But we haven't just come here to talk about lawn mowers and stuff. We've come here to talk about things that Jamie's interested in and knows more about than we do. Jamie picked up a few things in his kind of overview, but let's kick ourselves off with some questions. We'll come back to some of those themes along the way. Jamie, you used to be like an actual proper research investing person, right? Not just people who Google things like Steve and me. You used to be an equity research analyst, right? What did you do in that kind of job, and why did you stop?
Yeah, it was an interesting one because don't ask me what I don't know why, but from a very young age, for some reason, I was always interested in investing and the stock market. And yeah, I don't know where it came from, but I never actually thought I'd end up in that industry because it just seemed so, I don't know, I guess almost a tad just elite, and it wasn't something that I saw as, you know, doable. But no, honestly, I really enjoyed my time as an equity research analyst, you know. And it was actually, it's not like I'd done all the internships and stuff like that. Once I graduated university, I went to work in finance as a finance analyst for Vodafone, who I heard you guys talk about a month ago on this show, which was quite a fun destruction of the company. But I worked there for a while, wasn't necessarily enjoying it. And then it was actually someone that I used to play cricket with who had worked at Barclays for a while, and they were starting up their own equity research firm. So it was a bit of a risk for me. I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. I knew it was a risk, but at the same time, I thought, this is something I've always been interested in, something I've always wanted to be able to do a bit more properly. I'm probably not going to get another opportunity like this. So I said yes. And yeah, my main job was basically to write research reports on listed companies. And then that would then be available for various asset management firms to use when they chose to invest. And I'd already been doing a bit of investing by this point, but the amount that it taught me just kind of went through the roof. And I think it's really helped to shape the current approach that I had. But then you say, why did I stop? Well, it was a startup, and startups can come with some issues. I don't remember the exact number when it comes to startup failure, but I know it's pretty high. And sadly, it became quite clear to me, I think it was last year, that this startup was not necessarily going to succeed. But on a personal note, it worked out pretty well because I got that experience. And then at the time where it all kind of went wrong, everything had been going right with stocks and savings. So it almost worked out very well because it meant that I could get the experience from that. I think I did for a couple of years in the end. But then as that came to an end, stocks and savings started to grow, and I managed to take on that full time. Which, I mean, that has proven to be one of the best decisions in my life so far. So hopefully it stays that way.
You're both full-time on stocks and savings now, aren't you? Yeah, so.
Yeah, went full-time this year, this entire year.
That's impressive, Steve, considering when you look at our metrics and realise just how far away we are from part-time.
In terms of kind of viewers and revenues and stuff, yes, we look very like part-time. I mean, you and I look like full-timers and Paul looks like he doesn't exist. So it's a bit hard to work out which of us has gone full-time. But that's not true, actually. You look like a full-timer, I look like a part-timer, and Paul looks like a mascot. But
Paul looks like somebody who's been on sabbatical for about 15 years of the
which
2 years
kind
we've been
of
living
has, which he kind of has, in fairness. But, you know, that's the way things go from us. But that's really interesting. So when you were writing, Jamie, were you mostly writing for kind of long-term investor focus or short-term trader focus or specific industries or areas or kind of anything more specific than that?
So it was a value investing style firm. And As I'll get onto a bit later, my introduction to investing before that, my personal investing approach was shaped by David Gardner. He probably had the biggest influence on me, which is probably as far away from the classic value investor as you can get. So it was really different to what I'd been doing before. It was value investing with a long-term view. So, you know, that kind of stuff. And obviously looking at the quality of the companies, not just looking to make a quick buck here and there. And obviously that is something that I'd always had in my head when it came to investing as well. It was, obviously I didn't know the industry as well, but I was told that what we were doing was quite original in that the reports that we were putting out were a bit more succinct, but also a bit more easy to understand. It wasn't just, I know, like pages and pages of detail. It was kind of having a dashboard, having stuff that asset managers could not necessarily skim through, but they could read it. It might take an hour or two, and then they'd actually have a very good understanding of the company and decide whether or not they want to take it any further. But value investing, long term focus.
So just thinking about that, then, do you feel like that background as an analyst, does that give you something valuable to work on as a content creator? Does that give you something, a good basis for being a content creator?
Yeah, I mean, I think I learned an awful lot during my time as an analyst, and I think it really improved my ability not only to analyze companies but also to know how to put that across. Which is, it's great for a podcast, but as we found out quite early on, it's not really something that we can do on Instagram. So in that sense, there wasn't too much carryover, but probably one of the biggest things it gave me is motivation, because, whilst that industry is not exactly like Wolf of Wall Street in the film, but in my experience and from what I saw, there isn't a great amount of respect for individual investors. So whatever you might assume that industry thinks about when it thinks about individual investors, you're probably right. Which is also kind of funny, since that's basically all I was before I took up the role. And so it just struck me that the classic finance industry doesn't really have any plans to help the everyday investor all that much. So it makes me feel like what myself and Andrea are doing and podcasts like this one are doing even more important, because I think we all know that anyone can invest in a well-diversified global fund, and I do think a lot of people are able to research stocks and invest in individual stocks if they put in the time and the effort and are able to learn enough about it. And so I think what we're doing on Instagram, what you guys are doing here, we're just trying to open up the world of investing to as many people as possible. I think if anything, I took motivation from the role.
Yeah, this is something Damien from Damien Talks Money talks about as well. He used to work in debt management, and he said that essentially off the back of it, he thought that everything was so elitist and sort of inaccessible for just normal folk. And one of the things that happened in the pandemic is people like yourselves and people like Damien decided to try and simplify investing and finance and debt and everything for normal folk working at home, and that's probably where Steve and I probably came up with a podcast with Paul off the back of that as well. I suppose Casper is always part of the podcast. He was desperate to get us to make a podcast, and then he abandoned us when we needed an editor the most. But yeah, it's nice to see that that people are around that want to really help out the end users. I think it's tough, really, because I'm always twofold on it, and I think it's quite dangerous for people to talk about stocks, because I think there's going to be a certain degree of people who just listen to what Steve and I say and go and buy. It doesn't matter how many disclaimers we can stick on something. We may sound like we know what we're talking about with something like Vodafone, but we equally can miss something. But on the flip side of it, investing is
quite accurate.
Yeah, well, investing's like such an important thing. I think the major risks with investing is not doing it. Well, I suppose, and doing it incorrectly is also bad. But the major risk is, for me, is not just sticking your money in a savings account and thinking that will get you through to to retirement is not the way forward. But do you have any sort of color on that before we shuffle on?
No, I completely agree. Completely agree. And even if you don't want to invest in individual stocks, which I get it, even for me, who's able to kind of almost get away with doing it full time and dedicate a lot of time for it, it's a lot to stick on top of, to stay on top of, I don't know, 20 plus companies. But anyone can invest in a well diversified fund. And I think that's the biggest thing. It's like, we probably know that it's as simple as, top up a Train212 account with however much every month and just put it into this one fund, and you're probably going to be okay. But it's about making people feel confident and understand why that is an approach that has worked out in the long run, that is relatively, I don't want to say safe, because investing comes with risks, but that it is something that anyone can do. And history has shown that it is one of the best ways to build wealth.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was particularly interested in having you guys on the show is I'm always really interested when what I consider to be proper people start doing content creating, by which I mean people with some sort of qualifications and or experience and or knowledge, basically, of these sorts of things. Because you and both you and Andrea, if I'm right, are also chartered accountants by training or qualified as chartered accountants, right?
So yes, people who proper people is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, but proper people who at least know what they're looking for in a balance sheet. Because when I was kind of very, very first making my way into investing, I tried to learn about it through YouTube, and I didn't know much about investing back then. But I wasn't entirely silly, and not to pick on my favorite person for picking on here too much, because there's loads more like them. But I feel differently as a starting investor about videos made by a chartered accountant, not necessarily yours actually, but other chartered accountant qualified people, versus people whose main qualification appears to be being a retired card magician or something like that. So I'm always interested when proper people get into this, and I think, look, here's a thing I don't know and I don't understand. I'm not really sure quite how. I know there's lots that goes on in accounting, and people make things look different to how they are or do their best to. That strikes me as a giant game of cat and mouse. Maybe this person who knows about accounting and stuff can help me say, aha, see this thing, this number isn't really like this, or whatever. And I thought that was kind of helpful, but I found it kind of disappointing in the first instance. But I think you're right for what it's worth. There are I boil down in my head things quite a lot, and I try and simplify content creation into two things. Number one is knowing what you're talking about, and two is saying it in ways that other people can get to know what you're talking about. And I feel like between the two of us on this show, we very naturally fit onto either side of those sorts of things. So my day job mostly involves talking about complicated things and trying to get people to understand what they are, but they're not investing things or even investing adjacent related things. They're not even things in most cases. Whereas Steve has been spending much, much, much more time investing than I have and knows a lot more about this kind of stuff than I do. So we naturally, I think, have a kind of sort of balance between us. And then Paul provides the good looks and social media presence and so on. But I was kind of interested in the way that you think about these things, because I always like it when sort of proper people show up on here. You talked about some of the ways in which you and us are kind of similar, but not necessarily compared to us, but in general, what's the sort of unique thing about stocks and savings? There's loads of content creating things, right? You're bigger than some of the others, but what's the kind of thing that you're trying to do that other people don't do? Is it just that you're better than them?
Not at all. I think we've had our fair share of luck that I think anyone needs to have to get to a larger level, to get to a point where we're able to, I guess, capitalize on that luck and start to go full time. I've always said that I think we are probably the only people in the UK that benefited from Liz Truss's budget, because at that point, we basically, it was a perfect storm of the economy had kind of been thrown into a bit of a panic. Everyone knew that there was something to panic about, but no one really knew what that was. And it perfectly coincided with a time where Instagram was kind of like pushing, started to recommend grid posts on everyone else's feed. And we posted a few posts explaining what had gone on. And in a month, our following had gone from about 25K to over 60. There's a level of luck, but then it's also about being able to capitalize that on that. So, in terms of what makes us unique, I mean, there's loads of great pages on social media that are helping people to manage money. We see them as basically being in two buckets, saving and investing. Now, the biggest difference that we find is that a lot of the investing focused pages tend to be a bit, finance bro-y, a bit bombastic, and they can often be quite intimidating. Whereas the saving focused accounts are often far more approachable, but they're not exactly ideal for people who want to grow their money. So I think that we've managed to find a sweet spot somewhere in the middle, where we have a focus on trying to demystify investing and the more complex world of finance and economics, and we're able to do it in an approachable and easy to understand manner. And, you know, and we also try and offer general finance tips and tricks and anything to improve mindsets about finance and investing. You know, we've had the mission for the past couple of years to help everyone save, invest, and build wealth whilst enjoying life. And I guess everything we do is aiming towards that North Star.
You think a lot of it's down to just having original content as well? Because I see a lot of finance pages, they tend to just kind of regurgitate or copy and paste or screenshot other finance pages or channels. Well, their information, and then just kind of stick a new blurb underneath it. And you guys don't seem to do that. Yours is all, you know, original content, all sort of nicely branded and sort of designed in the way that you kind of got your own brand going here, really.
Yeah, I'm glad you say it, because we do try and do that, and it is one of the most difficult things to do. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier that among households says when it comes to, you know, in investing or finance, you know, there's however many, 4, 5, 6 real key points. And it's about figuring out how to repackage them and put them across so it doesn't feel like you're just, you know, repeating the same thing over and over again. And I feel like that's something that we work very hard to do. And it's not necessarily easy to notice for anyone that's just scrolling through Instagram. But I think being able to take any kind of education, put a personal twist on it if we can, and just put it across in a way that is going to capture attention. It's taken us years to get to this point, and we're still, you know, I don't know, maybe like 25% of our posts we'd say we are happy with. So it's taken a lot to get here.
That's a better hit rate than us, Steve.
Yeah, that is a better hit rate than us, actually. I was going to ask how you... So if we think that your stuff is, we turned off air, a combination of sort of fairly timeless and therefore never really in or out of fashion, kind of by definition here. So how do you work out what kind of, which of the kind of four aspects of finance you're going to kind of post about next in this situation? I mean, Steve mentioned that you've got your own kind of unique area or theme, so have we, right? And find me another podcast with stocks, cricket, and lawnmowers on it. How do you work out what to kind of talk about next? In our case, it used to be the story was it was the stuff that we talked about in our DMs during the course of the week, mostly just built out a little bit and actually kind of expanding those thoughts. Nowadays, if we stuck to that idea, we'd be off YouTube and off everywhere else in seconds. But where do you get your ideas from?
So I'd say there's probably two main places that we get them from at the minute. One is our lives. So and this is something that we've really tried to push over the last year, is, and it's a bit annoying because you can't really turn it off, but basically anything in your life, it's like, okay, how does this relate to finance? How does this relate to something that people find interesting? How does this relate to something that will help people to improve their situation? I mean, we posted, I think on Thursday, basically explaining our mortgage journey, which was quite an interesting one because we bought a house in September 2020. And like the financial geniuses we are, we fixed on a nice low rate for 2 years. September 2021. So we fixed on a nice low rate for 2 years. And then about a year or so later, Liz Truss's budget, mortgage rates skyrocketed. And we were like, oh God, we are like, we're screwed, basically. If mortgage rates are like this when we have to remortgage, then we're screwed. Especially since at that point, we just decided to go full-time on stocks and savings. So if we went to get a different mortgage, we weren't going to get approved for an affordability check. So I think it was actually on the day of the mini budget, we paid an early exit fee and remortgaged at about 3.7 or 8% for 5 years, simply because we knew we could afford that. Things might have got better a year later. Doesn't necessarily look like that would have been the case, but we didn't know. We just stuck with, you know, what we knew would work. And that's something that we kind of we posted about on Thursday. We kind of explained our whole thought process behind it. And I mean, that ended up being one of our best performing posts this year, I think. So just stuff like that, drawing off anything in our day-to-day lives that can be used to help people. And then also seeing what people are thinking about, what people are maybe more worried about or need help understanding at the minute, which obviously inflation and mortgage rates have been the big story of the last year. So those kind of two things we draw from, what's in the news and then our personal experience.
That's looking like a shrewd move at the moment, definitely.
It's complete fluke, because we were there, we were like, you know, rates could go back down and then we end up paying way more than we expected. In hindsight, it looks brilliant, but I promise you, it was just panic.
we moved into this house during the pandemic when the stamp duty, reduced stamp duty was still in, and we fixed for 5 years. This is going to make you sick to your back teeth at 1.19. So we look like the smartest people in the room, but honestly, that was just a case of, oh, come on. But we're sick of the neighbours arguing, and she was the neighbour at the time was a heavy drinker as well. And for some reason, they had a toilet in the middle of the house. Now, I think about this as somebody who builds houses. How the hell do they get the toilet from the middle of the house out of the house? How do they get the waste out without it travelling through various rooms, you know, through a pipe that could sever at some point? And it made me sick. But the worst part of that was, because she was a heavy drinker, she obviously liked to eject that product in the morning, and you could hear her, and we were like, you know what, we're gonna move. That was a real reason. So imagine, I don't think that post would go down as well on Instagram, Steve. I don't know about you, but
different market, mate.
Yeah, that's this one for our market, not for yours. But
I completely disagree. I think that would be perfect.
I locked in the best mortgage because my neighbor was disgusting.
Yeah, next week, why Johnny Bairstow is terrible.
No.
Okay, aside from the kind of research writing stuff, you're still writing a bit, or have been writing a bit, with Seeking Alpha. What's the kind of story there? Do you enjoy that, or do you do it for the money, or for the interest, or what?
Yes. yes to all three. It follows quite nicely from the end of my story as an equity research analyst, because it was towards the back end of my time at the startup when it became more clear to me that there were issues, with one of the main issues being that my pay was basically non-existent. So I had to figure out a way of making some money to get by. I just kind of stumbled upon Seeking Alpha, which I guess for anyone that doesn't know is a website kind of like The Motley Fool, in that it's full of articles and buy and sell recommendations on companies. If you don't know what The Motley Fool is, you should know what The Motley Fool is. Very good resource. And you do some writing for them as well, don't you? I'd say one of the differences with Seeking Alpha is that anyone can write articles. Although all the articles and writers on the website are vetted to make sure that they at least kind of know what they're talking about. So I basically took everything I learned about researching companies and writing research reports and just channeled that into writing for Seeking Alpha. So now it's just become something that I do whenever I review the results of companies in my portfolio. So rather than just reading through the results, I'll write an article on Seeking Alpha, which, you know, it helps me to make a little bit of income, but it also helps me to keep track of the earnings from all the companies I own. So I guess it's a bit of a win-win.
Yeah, very familiar sounding story to the reasons I write for Motley Fool. But I think Seeking Alpha is structured slightly differently, and I think you probably have a more noble calling than me. So how do you make money on Seeking Alpha? Or tell me about the kind of structure there. I'll compare it to the stuff I do as a freelancer for Fool in a minute for you.
Oh, noble calling is a strong.
You haven't heard what I'm going to come out with in a second. But
okay. So there's a few different ways that you can get paid on Seeking Alpha. Every article, assuming you publish exclusively to Seeking Alpha, because there are different things you can do, then every article will pay you a certain variable amount based on the number of views. So that's one way to do it. It's quite simple. The biggest companies, the more interesting companies, they get more views. They also get more articles written about them. So, yeah, it's a bit of a coin toss. And then they also have something called undercovered articles, which is where if an article hasn't been written about for, or I think if it's only been written about once in the past 30 days, they'll give you a bonus somewhere between $45 and $65, normally closer to $45 if it's a company that anyone has heard of, to write an article about it. So that's quite handy as well for some of these smaller companies in my portfolio that I still want to write about. The only downside for that is that you'll find that no one will post about a company for about 3 weeks. And then as soon as this hits, you have about 5 articles on the company come out all at once. So it's not perfect, but I think it works for us authors. And I think it must work for the people reading them as well, because everyone seems quite happy there.
Yeah, I've definitely seen some really good stuff on Seeking Alpha. I think I've generally found it slightly variable, but in general, I think the standard's been decent, and there's definitely been some stuff on there that I've found has added kind of genuine value. Motley Fool, by the way, just very quickly works slightly differently. We're paid a fixed fee for every article we write. We're never told what we can or can't write about. We're encouraged to write about certain things, but the basic metric they use to measure performance is how many people do you get to sign up for some sort of premium subscription, or how many sign up via your articles. So if you just write about whatever the hell you want for ages and do it a lot, you'll get fired quite quickly.
I thought it'd be articles about Lloyd's Bank. I thought that would be how
So it is and it isn't, Steve, to be honest. Lloyd's Bank and Rolls-Royce are two things that always seem to generate people to sign up for stuff. And no one has ever said to me, or I imagine any other contractor there, you must say this about Lloyd's or you must not say that about Rolls or whatever. They have said, look, one of the things we notice is that people who write about this a lot tend to generate a lot of leads and subscriptions. You make of that what you will. You can write about it or not. But if you don't and the stuff you do doesn't, then... you know, straightforward proposition, it's not going to go too well for you. They're perfectly transparent about that. They're perfectly upfront about it. I think I would remind people that everything I write for Motley Fool is strictly, in its deepest sense, to do with generating leads for stuff rather than to do with informing people. And you might generate leads via informing people because they think, oh, that's clever, I'll sign up for this thing because I want to find out more stuff. But it's a lead generating thing rather than Jamie's kind of thing, which is a more, I guess, not unfiltered stream of consciousness, but he doesn't have the same kind of pressures on him to write about these things. So he's interested in the way Seeking Alpha kind of works there.
Yeah, the cynics for Seeking Alpha would say that because there's a variable fee based on how many people read the article, that it could be a little bit more clickbaity. And there are some, you know, don't get me wrong, I do think there are some brilliant people that put out some great content. But I did read an article the other day, which kind of, it wound me up a tiny bit. Because I just written an article reviewing Tesla's results. You know, you have to rate them between a strong sell or a strong buy. Put a hold after their results. You know, I thought they were good, but there's some worrying signs, and the valuation is, isn't it always, a little bit extreme.
Fruity.
But this guy had done a DCF on Tesla and come up with a target price of $26, or a fair value of $26. Don't know what Tesla is in the minute. I think it's probably around 180, maybe.
It's higher, I think. I think it's in the 200s, isn't it, at the moment?
Or in the 200s, wherever it is, it's a lot higher than $26. And the great thing about Seeking Alpha is you can see what people have done in the past. And I normally don't comment on any other authors, you know, because I know it's never nice if you get a negative comment. But I had to point out that since August 2013, this guy had written, I think, 19 articles on Tesla, all of them with a sell or a strong sell recommendation. And I just kind of asked, is there anything that would change your mind? Because Tesla shares are up about 2,600%, I think, since then. And the last 5 years, it has done well. Valuation is a different debate. Clearly, it's got very overheated at times. But I guess there's that downside as well. But yeah, I like it. It works well for me, and I think that it allows me to yeah, do the reviews for myself and for everyone else on there. So it works out quite nicely.
Was it Christopher Bloomstrom? Was it him? He hates Tesla. His threads on Twitter, X now, are incredible. The 35 just stream threads of him, his hate for Tesla and everything about it. And at the end, it's like, strong sell, $16.
He is
like
pretty good, though, Chris Bloomstrom. I mean, he knows good, yeah. Stuff about stuff, right? He's not just...
He does, yeah. Yeah, his arguments at least have some thought to them at times. But he's just if you're looking at something and saying, "Well, is this bullish or bearish?" He's just straight bearish. This is also bearish. It sold more cars, bearish.
We got hammered for our coverage on Tesla a couple of weeks ago. I can see that happening again.
Yes,
anyway,
well, we get hammered for our coverage on Tesla because we're massively indifferent to it. We just look down at it and say, "Yeah, that's fine," and then we get like. To like from Deval, like 20 point things of all the things we were wrong, and we got hammered on the trading 212 community as well because we didn't, what was it, we didn't say that the robots were in factories by the end of the year or something.
A lot of things, didn't talk about the dojo thing, didn't talk about the energy arm, didn't talk about Elon saying a bunch of things.
I think we said it was a car company at one point.
These are all fair criticism. These are all absolutely true, by the way, of our coverage. And look, people who know more about it than we do will justifiably have better views on it than we do.
My favourite thing about that is people say, why aren't you covering Tesla? Why won't you talk about Tesla? And then we talk about with the sort of mild indifference of two people who don't want to talk about Tesla, and I say, you're not doing it right.
I will point out, the person who was correctly pointing out the shortcomings of what was mostly me talking about Tesla on the 212 forum, quite a nice guy, and we got into a nice chat about cricket by the end of it, from what I remember of that conversation. But we have more on cricket and Tesla. Let's talk about something different. Jamie, all roads seem to lead back there, or at least they do when you have a weird kind of FSD thing. Never mind. Right, so Instagram is your kind of main platform at the moment. You were a YouTuber for a bit, and you have a podcast as well. But why Instagram as a main kind of platform, Jamie?
I mean, that's a good question. I'd love to pretend that it was a great strategic decision. You know, where we spotted an attractive gap in the market, but it was nothing like that. We opted for Instagram simply because it seemed like the easiest to maintain whilst we were doing our full-time jobs. Little did we know that actually when you do want to grow and keep your engagement up and all of that, Instagram demands a hell of a lot of time. But, you know, it's worked out so far, and we also decided, you know, we should pick one platform that we wanted to grow on and, you know, grow on that. And then from that, you know, maybe we can use that following to branch off into different areas. So, you know, that's where we launched a YouTube from for a time. That's where we launched a podcast from. And we are also thinking of maybe starting a newsletter in September as well. It's just a nice platform we've got now to try and launch things and reach different people in different ways and talk about different things.
Yeah, nice platform. It's sizable now, nearly 88,500 followers, Steve. That's quite impressive considering I'm just looking at the account now. It's not been going an awful long time, Steve. It's been going about as long as we have, so growing at an exponential. Steve and I often joke that we may have one of the slowest growing podcasts in the history of the world, especially on YouTube, where we seem to go backwards sometimes. We can go from 700 views to 300 views on YouTube, and then you look at the podcast on Spotify, and it does often, you know, 2, 3, 4 times that amount. So it's very difficult for us to sort of justify YouTube editing a full video, but that's something that you've tried and it didn't work out too well for you. What was your thoughts and experience with YouTube?
When in terms of why it didn't work out, I mean, it sounds like it's quite similar, and the short answer would be time. You know, I really enjoyed making those videos that were trying to analyze companies in like 15 minutes. Albeit, I think my approach to analyzing stocks has evolved a lot since I started posting those videos, which was probably going back at least a year or 2 years ago. So it's mainly the time and the editing that restricts me. You know, I think that if we do manage to keep growing and we could potentially hire someone to help out with creating the slides for the videos and editing the recordings, then, you know, I definitely consider setting up the channel again. But I mean, it's, as you say, I mean, with any kind of social media, whether it's Instagram or a podcast or YouTube or, you know, whatever it is, it seems so difficult to grow. I mean, you know, you talk about our growth being exponential from kind of like when we started to about, I don't know, like to 2 years after, we kind of steadily grown. Like from the first year, we went from 0 to 10K followers in exactly a year. And then 1 year later, we'd gone from 10K to 20K followers. So it was very, very linear. And then, yeah, we had a few things come together and we've managed to capitalize on it, but it's hard. I don't really, I wouldn't say that we've cracked any secret yet.
Yeah, Steve says we have the slowest growing podcast on YouTube. That might be true. Clues in the name a bit, right? You stick Footsie in there and all of a sudden growth just goes straight out the window. or it might be to do with the fact we say things like that. But you guys are going quite nicely. And YouTube can be a time-consuming thing. And I have sort of one eye on this because we lean hard on the fact that at least during our history, we've had two people that can edit shows. Realistically, Steve does sort of nearly all of them. Unfortunately for us, Steve has no major life commitments coming up at all over the next year or so that might cut into his available time or anything of that sort. Figuring out how to edit these things is kind of on my list. We did have someone else to do it, but we didn't pay them, so they went away again, which is sort of justifiable, really. And I get that YouTube's quite a lot of work. It's something I'm going to think about going forward as well. On to slightly more prosaic things, I guess, for the moment then. You talked about kind of refining your investing style in your time as a research analyst and so on. And you mentioned your kind of David Gardner influence. But how would you describe your investing style?
Well, firstly, congratulations, Steve. That was the most surprising evolution of an acorn I ever saw. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'd love to say it was planned, but it wasn't. I just grew an acorn and thought this would be nice. This would might be a nice way of revealing it.
Or was it not planned? I was convinced.
No, I am an incredibly stupid person. I only put two and two together probably about 3 days beforehand.
The acorn bit was not planned, right? The other bit.
Oh, yeah, the other bit was planned, yeah.
Well, congrats. investing style, my investing style, right. Probably the best way to describe it for me would be to talk about some of the people who've influenced my investing journey. Because, you know, back in 2019, I hadn't started investing. I didn't know anything about investing. So I guess I've been learning about it for, 4 years now? I guess still quite, still very new to the world, and still a lot that have been learned over that time. As I mentioned, you know, it probably is David Gardner who's influenced me the most, who's co-founder of The Motley Fool, and he has this approach of rule breaker investing that basically looks to invest in leading companies in important or growing industries, and focusing on a combination of the quality of the company right now and also the opportunity that it has ahead. And this approach lends itself to growth stocks naturally and a lot of tech stocks, although I've since tried to diversify a little bit more. And through this method, you know, I feel like I've invested in some brilliant companies, some not so brilliant ones, but we'll get onto that in a sec. And another person who influenced me, I guess my earlier days, was Brian Stoffel, who has this anti-fragile approach to investing, with the theory being that no one knows what's going to happen in the future. It's basically unpredictable. So especially if you are taking the approach of investing in high growth companies that are looking to disrupt certain industries or certain areas. So you're better off investing in companies are not only built to survive difficult times, but who also have the potential to thrive when there is uncertainty. So, you know, this could include companies that have strong or multiple economic moats, have management with skin in the game, so insider ownership, that have a strong balance sheet and cash position to survive any shocks and capitalize when everyone else is struggling and they're sitting on a bucket load of cash, and that have plenty of optionality. So, you know, different ways to win and succeed. And this definitely drives my investing approach this day. I think my largest holding at the minute is maybe one of the best examples of a company that did go through a huge shock very recently and came out of it so much stronger, which is Airbnb. So back in 2020, 2021, obviously travel restrictions, lockdowns, not very great for Airbnb, but the company had co-founders, has a founder and CEO roles, Brian Chesky. I think the chief operating officer is a co-founder as well. And there's another co-founder who left recently, but is still on the board. And between them, they own, I think, over 30% of the company, which is quite crazy when you consider Airbnb is probably one $80, $90 billion company right now. So you know, they had that skin in the game. They had a net cash position of like $8 billion, I think. They had an extremely strong network effect, strong brand, and an asset-light business model. And all this meant that when the pandemic hit, they were in a position to cope where a lot of other travel companies maybe did not do so well. And what they also did during that time was they got more efficient. And what we saw in 2022, and I hope we're going to keep seeing in 2023, I think Q1 was relatively positive, is that this company has just turned into a free cash flow machine. I mean, it's just printing cash for fun. And it's in a much stronger position than it was in 2019. So I feel like that just so happens to be the perfect example of a company that went through a shock and came out much stronger. The problem with the approach that David Gardner, Brian Stoffel were taking, and that I learned from, was that they were saying in 2020 and 2021, essentially, the valuation isn't something to worry about all that much. And that over the long run, the highest quality companies will be fine. I agree with this to an extent, but we saw a bubble form and burst in these types of high growth companies in 2021 through to 2022. So I've learned the hard way to pay a lot more attention to valuation. And by the hard way, I mean my portfolio got cut in half, and in fact, probably a bit more from its highs in 2021 to its lows in 2022. But this combination of searching for high quality, anti-fragile companies at reasonable valuations, or at least not crazy valuations, has served me well in the last 12 months. And over that time, my portfolio is up almost 100%, which is not a brag because my portfolio is still making a loss overall over the last 3 years. I think, but I've gone from being about almost seeing an almost 50% loss on trading 212 to now, I think I'm at a 1% loss. And that's happened in the last 12 months. So clearly a lot of volatility in these companies as well. But honestly, I couldn't be happier about that given how things went in 2020 and 2021. And I hope that now I've just managed to refine my investing approach more and more to get something that can lead to long-term success.
It's one of those things, isn't it? Because a lot of people think, well, last year was a really bad year. Stocks across the board lost money. But what they don't know is that people like me and you who are in the higher growth kind of maybe higher valuation, some would say, kind of stocks, we had a bad 6 months prior to that as well. So we had about 18 months of sort of being kicked in the nuts, but whereas everybody else just had sort of an eight month period, or maybe 10 months, because I think in October it kind of bottomed and turned around. But yeah, interesting to see Airbnb being your biggest position. It's one that I've bought a position in when after IPO, it dropped quite a bit. I bought it. It ran up a lot. I sold it and then it fell again after having a couple of bad earnings report. And I ended up buying it about $82, I think, which has been a very, very good purchase. But I've done the thing that Steve and I always do where we buy a small position in something in the hope that we will be able to flesh that position out over time. And Airbnb is a race stuff. I think I'm up about 70% in it at the moment, but I only put about 1.5% of my capital in. And it's one of those things that in my pie, I've got it sat there as like, I want to bring this to a 3.5% or a 3% position. And it's about 1.5 realistically. And I don't want to buy it at this kind of valuation. It's a much trickier thing for me to buy. I mean, I struggle buying Rightmove that was up sort of 10%. Airbnb are up 60 is even trickier for me. But you did say there was some stinkers in there. What's the worst performing one?
Well, there were a couple of ones that I did trim. One of my approaches as well is I do generally like to hold onto companies. I have a little pie. I guess it's not too dissimilar to your Capital Incinerator one, which I basically call just companies I don't follow anymore. Mm. Because again, something that I think I picked up from some Motley Fool podcasts is they have, when they look back at what they've done, they are generally better off if they've never sold any stocks. And so I thought, I'll take that approach for the most part. But there were a couple that I did get rid of. One that I know is a favorite of this show, it's Mighty Teladoc. That was a...
I joined you there. Awful.
Shocking. Mm. I actually owned Livongo before they acquired it. But God, that went badly. In terms of... So I wrote that probably about 80% down, and then there was also Zillow, didn't work out. One that, if you had asked me at the start of this year, I would have easily said Upstart. For anyone that doesn't know, Upstart is basically a company that claims to have a better way to do credit scores in the United States, so FICO scores. Yeah, using machine learning and artificial intelligence before it was cool. But apparently now that artificial intelligence is cool, I think shares of Upstart, I was down 90% at one point, but I was like, okay, I can see where I went wrong. But the long-term thesis for this company, I still think it's there. And now I think I'm only about 44% down on it because it has had a ridiculous 2023. But I mean that was my biggest mistake up until this year, because it was one of my larger holdings and I just got it all wrong.
Upstart is a tricky one, isn't it? Because they basically curated loans and then sold it on to a partner institute, so they never really was exposed to the loans themselves, because they were quickly just shipping them off. And then a period of last year they just started taking them on the balance sheet, and they started off by saying, oh, don't worry about it, it's just R&D. And you're like, oh, okay, I think I can let's take that at face value and believe. And then the next quarter came out and they'd like trebled the amount of loans they held on the balance sheet. Like, this has stopped being R&D. This is people not wanting to buy your loans. But they actually improved on that situation. And do you want Upstart to be a lender who holds loans on the balance sheet? It's definitely a different kind of enterprise to what it was prior, you know, when everybody wanted to buy debt from everybody. It's a different kind of operation today. But I agree with you in that I actually removed it from the Capital Incinerator pie because I just thought this is a disaster waiting to happen. And I know the CEO, Dave Girard, he had all sorts of management consultants in to just come and help him be a better CEO around the period. And I thought, this just sounds to me like this is a recipe for disaster. But in credit to him, he stepped aside. Now, has he gone to president and got somebody else in spot? I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think he's actually done a very, very good job of sort of managing the sort of crisis that Upstart went through and beginning to see the other side of it now, where I think perhaps this was, I was sort of unfairly critical of how it was getting on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all seems fair. Upstart is still sat in my companies I don't follow pie now, because I don't want to say that I gave up on it, because I still thought I could still see the potential. So, you know, I'll leave it there. It was a bit of a dumpster fire right now, or 6 months ago, but apparently things are looking a lot better now. I know I got a lot more funding. So I wasn't going to be going busting anytime soon. But yeah, it's been quite a recovery.
Penalty box. That's what they call it in Motley Fool, isn't it?
Yes. That's why I should rename it too. But that was also because I ended up owning too many stocks, and I was like, I don't like looking at all of this. So I don't know if you know you can do this on Train212. I certainly didn't. But if you chuck something in a pie, you can then filter your investments and hide the pie. So I was just like, right, you go over there. I don't want to worry about you anymore. I will focus on these companies that I want to focus on.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, it's very much your kind of thing, isn't it, Steve? Okay, enough about shortcomings of various things. We like to be positive on this show. We do like to be positive about other content creators as well, actually, because there are a lot that we respect very highly. We disagree with them in places, and that's just the nature of things. And mostly we're wrong and they're not. But there are plenty of other YouTubers, podcasters, Instagrammers that we think, actually Twitter users as well, no, X users, sorry, as they are now, that we find really, really helpful. Steve, you described, you called it Twitter at the time because it was ages ago, it was one of your kind of best resources for finding stuff. But Jamie, who do you like kind of content creation-wise? We talked a little bit about Motley Fool already, but is there anyone else that you particularly think adds kind of value to your thinking?
This is slightly embarrassing, but I would say that, you know, you get that one, I don't know you two are podcast listeners, but you often get that one podcast that you're like, each week when that comes out, that's the first one you listen to.
Mm-hmm.
It is this podcast for me.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was a boss hog. Never mind.
That's very nice of you.
No, it is you guys, and I think that what I managed to get from this podcast is that where my earlier days of investing have been influenced, you know, by the likes of David Gardner and Brian Stoffel, and I guess quite a, I don't want to say more abstract approach to investing, but, you know, they look to, there's a level of wishful thinking that goes on with it. And I feel like this podcast makes me feel like a bit more of a grown up. In that I feel like when it comes to companies that you talk about, because there are some companies that I've heard you guys talk about. I think there was Deckers was one that you bought a while ago. Mm. And it just sounded brilliant. Like, you know, the fact that they have the cash cow of the Uggs and the real growth driver of Hoka, whatever it's called. Whatever it's called, it's a good shoe, apparently. and they've done incredibly. There was another company that I think you bought, I want to say a month ago, like a pop-up house builder in America?
Yeah, that was Kavco.
That's the one. I haven't looked much into it, but from everything you said, I was like, how do you find a company like that out of curiosity? How does that pop up on your radar?
So this is something I spoke about when I was on the Investor Way podcast. I tried to basically explain to them how the answer to that question is to really cast a really wide net and keep your ear to the ground. So one of the things I do is I follow about 100 people on Twitter. So I look for it to come up there. Spend an awful lot of time looking at companies. So it's just a really strange thing. I think Steve and I have had this discussion before where I said I used to really like Football Manager when I was a kid. And one of my favorite things to do would just be to trawl through other teams to see what players they had and, you know, whether I could buy them. And I've taken a similar approach to investing, really. And I'm really happy to just trawl through an ETF. And well, Steve used to do this with the Catholic Values ETF back in the day. He used to trawl through the Catholic Values ETF looking for stocks. And that's something that I'm quite happy to do. So if you give me something like ISP6, and I'll go find out what the index is, and then I'll just sit and trawl through, you know, maybe the first 100, 150 in that, and just quickly screen them with my own eyes. If they're worth looking at a little bit further, add them to a watch list. And then once I'm finished trawling through the index, I'll start to go through them and weed them out. So that's generally how I look for things.
That's a delightfully misleading way of putting what I get up to in looking through ETFs things. I think that might be the funniest things Steve's ever said on this show. Well done, Steve. Take a bow. Yeah, okay. So, good. Our viewers are in the right place then. Nothing else to see on YouTube. Don't worry about any of it. Just hang on here for the time being. Okay, last kind of question before we get into a stock of a sort then. Obviously, on this show, we don't do financial advice because we're not finance professionals. I'm not sure whether you do financial advice or not because you are not. Cool. Good. So, you're in the right place then in that case. But just for our viewers who are listening and looking for stuff that isn't financial advice, what would you say the most underrated bit of not financial advice you've heard is, or you'd like to pass on for our listeners?
I mean, this is quite a tough one. It's quite tough to just kind of pick out one thing and then also to say something that hasn't been said 1,000 times before. But I think, yeah, I'll go with something that's, I guess, a bit more investing focus. And I feel like this is maybe particularly apt to follow on from talking about different social media resources, you know, stuff like Twitter as well, because Twitter is another place where I find a lot of ideas and where I feel like I learn quite a lot about companies. But one thing that I find in the world of investing is there's a lot of people that put themselves in a box of, you know, I'm a growth investor, or I'm a value investor, or I'm a dividend investor. And it's very easy to find that you have that belief that your approach is the only successful way to invest. But I think that by having that view, you know, you're closing yourself off from a bunch of potentially great investments. So I guess my advice would be to always be open to different ideas, different opportunities, and, you know, don't get stuck in one of those boxes when it comes to investing. Because at the end of the day, particularly if you have decades ahead, really your goal should be to make as much from investing as possible, whatever way you can do that. So yeah, I think that's a big thing for me.
I think that's great, not advice, by the way. I mean, the way I think, that's something I've heard before, and I think it's a really important thing to think about, that sometimes when we look at markets and we see stocks moving around and we see things at what seem like ridiculous prices, either high or low, you ask yourself, who's buying there and who's selling there, and why is anyone doing that? And the answer is almost invariably, it's some pension fund or something like that. And the explanation is because they have to. Because they have a specific mandate that says you need to own this amount of this, or you can only go and buy and sell in this area, and you have to balance like this. Don't care what the prices are. If the prices aren't helpful, that's your problem. You have to go and buy and sell things at those prices anyway. And maybe the biggest advantage the likes of us have is that we don't have that. And so to immediately say, okay, I'm a UK investor, I'm a growth investor, I'm a dividend investor, I'm a REIT investor, or whatever, and say, fine, I'm now going to force myself into this kind of area and ignore everything else, just seems like picking up all the kind of problems that at least we get the luxury of avoiding. Steve?
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's something we sort of parrot often here, that the only thing that matters is total return. And when you're a millionaire in retirement or millionaire as a pensioner, like, nobody's going to say to you, well, how did you get there? And was it only buying companies with a PE of 8? Do you know what I mean? Like, nobody's going to, it doesn't matter how you got there. All that matters is buying the right stocks. I do find that the only reason I can see to pigeonhole yourself like that is because it just lowers the amount of stocks that you have to search through to find the ones that you want to buy. They're the only way I could see of sort of wanting to pigeonhole yourself like that. But Steve, should we move on? Because I'm sort of acutely aware we're using a lot of Jamie's time here.
We are using a lot of Jamie's time, but thinking about stocks that might be interesting in, Jamie's got something that, I mean, I don't know if I've heard of this one before, but Steve, you may be more familiar with this than me. Jamie, what stock have you been looking at that you'd like to tell us about?
So I was wondering what stock to bring. I was kind of looking through my portfolio and I felt like I wanted to bring something a bit different, something that people maybe have heard of, or at least haven't thought of as a potential investment. So I've gone for HelloFresh, which I know is quite dangerous to bring to a podcast that really favors Gusto. I feel like I'm bringing an Android to the Apple store, but let's see how it goes anyway. So HelloFresh is, I think that a few people have, or hopefully a decent number of people know what the product is. So let's talk about it as an investment. It's a German company listed on the German Stock Exchange. And at the time of recording, it has a market capitalization of just under 4.5 billion euros. I don't know if that's going to be higher or lower than you guys expected. But as a quick introduction, HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery services company that ships weekly boxes of fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and recipes to its customers that are a lot easier to make than Gusto, with step-by-step instructions that enable anyone to make tasty homemade meals. It's the largest meal kit delivery company in the world, and it's continued to dominate its most important market of the United States. So to put that into a bit of context, back in 2019, HelloFresh accounted for around 50% of all meal kit sales in the United States, according to Bloomberg's second measure, which, I mean, is pretty impressive in itself. But then its market share in the United States in 2022 was a whopping 78%. And the company has just gone from strength to strength. It also acquired ready-to-eat meal company Factor back in late 2020 for just under $3 million. Just under $300 million. And Factor basically offers fresh meals that you can simply stick in the microwave or oven and, you know, done. So kind of like microwave meals, but healthier and fresher. And this has been a success so far, with Factor's market share soaring since the acquisition. And it now accounts for 80% of the ready-to-eat market in the United States. And it's become a real growth driver for the company, with Factor's revenue growing at a triple-digit rate in 2022, alongside a break-even adjusted EBITDA margin, and that's certainly one to watch. Adjusted EBITDA margins for that should reach 10%, and I think it currently accounts for 12% of revenue. So 12% of revenue growing at triple digits in 2020, that's quite a nice growth driver there. Now, it probably won't be a surprise that all of these meal kit providers saw stellar growth in 2020 and 2021 as everyone was stuck inside. And they saw a real drop in demand in 2022 as the world opened up. Despite all this, HelloFresh still managed to grow its revenue by 27% in 2022, reaching 7.6 billion euros. And perhaps the biggest surprise for a company like this is that HelloFresh is profitable, which is a surprise for me because I see the number of discounts I get sent and I'm like, there's no way they're making money on this. Like they're just trying to grow customers. And in fact, when I think it was probably 2020 when I first stumbled across HelloFresh and I looked at its numbers, I was just like, how is this company making money? But it is. It made an operating income of 216 million euros in 2022, which represented a 2.8% operating margin, and a net income of 127 million euros. Now, 2.8% operating margin is, I mean, it's, I guess, a profit. And net income was profitable, but it's not like it's a great margin. So it's worth pointing out that these profits came at a time of mass expansion for the company and investment. And it was also facing a whole host of headwinds, from food inflation to the soaring cost of energy in its supply chain, to general economic uncertainty, which maybe made people think, I guess we can go to the supermarket if we have to. So with all these headwinds starting to ease up now, and HelloFresh's latest investment cycle slowing down, I think its CapEx spend peaked in 2022. This company, I'm hoping, should be able to flex its muscles with profitability and free cash flow once again. In fact, the free cash flow potential is what makes HelloFresh pretty compelling right now for me. So the company's free cash flow was negative 59 million euros in 2022, as all of the headwinds that I just mentioned started to bite. But analysts expect the company to deliver 247 million euros in free cash flow in 2023 and 343 million euros worth of free cash flow in 2024. And in fact, by 2025, management is targeting 10 billion euros in revenue and adjusted EBITDA margins of around 10%, and also what it calls attractive free cash flow per share, whatever that means. For some reason, I have in my head that management were targeting 500 million in free cash flow by 2025, but I then couldn't find that anywhere when I was double checking this and putting it together. So maybe they'll do that. Maybe I'm making it up. But analysts seem to think that they're heading that way. So if we think about that in terms of valuation, My personal approach to valuation, it's something that I have to do because the companies that I invest in, I can't really look at PEs right now. I can't really look at multiples right now. I generally try and think about, okay, what can they grow to over, I think I generally look over a 5-year time period. What can they grow over to? What can their margins expand to? And how would that look like at a reasonable multiple? And then working backwards, does it look crazily overvalued or undervalued? That's my general approach, valuation. And that's how I try and avoid getting into a situation I was in 2020 and 2021, where I was investing in companies where they had to achieve ridiculous results to merit their valuations. So in terms of valuation for HelloFresh, I feel like it could be quite compelling right now if it manages to achieve these results. So if the company trades at 10 times its adjusted EBITDA in 2025, which I feel like is a fairly conservative multiple because I'm using proxies like Tesco and Walmart, which shouldn't be growing at the pace of HelloFresh. They should be growing more slowly. Then that would give it a 10 billion euro market cap by 2025 and a 30% share price compound annual growth rate from now until then. Now, as I said, I don't place too much of a focus on valuation. Obviously saying, oh, a 30% compound annual growth rate, that's an attractive number. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. But all that I'm ascertaining from that is that I think HelloFresh shares are attractive right now. But I have no idea where they will actually be in 2025. The good news for me is that HelloFresh ticks a lot of the boxes I look for in companies. You know, it's a leader in a growing industry. It has a huge moat with its scale compared to any of its competitors. It has a founder in the CEO and the COO roles, and the CEO owns about 4% of the shares outstanding. I also think that it has a decent amount of optionality within the business as it expands into ready-to-eat meals. It has a net cash position of around 300 million euros, and it's expected to return to delivering free cash flow in the hundreds of millions in 2023 and beyond. So, well, that sounds like fun. What's the downside? What's the risk? For me, I think the biggest risk revolves around the market for meal kits themselves. And particularly if they're considered a luxury good, then they may well be hit by any recession that we're seeing. And also whether or not they're a fad. I think that's something that's always a bit of a worry here, as maybe I'm a bit biased as someone who uses meal kits and has done for the last couple of years, but I don't necessarily see myself going back to not using them. But I think that is definitely a risk if they do die down. We're also seeing a slowdown for HelloFresh in 2023, with analysts forecasting zero to low single-digit revenue growth. And I guess another risk is that the company doesn't actually recover from this slump. From, I think, this point onwards, management assumed revenue grew about 11 or 12% to hit those targets that it set out, which is not crazy, but given that the growth has kind of flatlined this year, could be another potential risk. And then there's also the risk of competition, and particularly that comes from a larger, well-established player, such as Home Chef in the US, which is backed by Kroger, as this could reduce the impact of HelloFresh's scale as being a very nice moat. But HelloFresh has been competing with Home Chef in the US and succeeding over time. So where we saw HelloFresh taking more market share, Home Chef's market share has been shrinking. So that shows me that it can hold its own against competition. But again, that's always going to be a risk, especially if the industry starts to look more attractive. So that's why I decided to bring to the podcast. Mainly because I know that we have some Gusto fans here. And just a full disclosure, I do own shares of HelloFresh. I think it's my 7th or 8th largest holding.
Interesting. I was looking at HelloFresh this morning. I was Googling all kinds of things. I also found a thing called Hello Group and then realized that's not the same thing. HelloFresh, yeah, you're right. It has a massive PE, right? But you want to look a bit more carefully at that kind of PE. When I looked, I saw different numbers. They were all quite big. 57 was one that I saw somewhere. But I did look at it and thought, well, they're running at a 2% margin at the moment, and that's been coming in quite a bit over the last couple of years, down from, it's been roughly halving and then halving again over the last couple of years. So then I sort of thought to myself, these are operating margins, by the way, that I'm looking at here, for 11.4, 6.6, 3.2. And if you think, okay, revenue's now around $8-something billion, market cap's around $4.5 billion. If we make our way back to an 11.4% margin somehow, because this is a US-ish exposed company quite a bit, and inflation in the US is not the same thing as inflation over here. Inflation in the US is going away quite sharply, so you might think the sting will come out of that a little bit. If those margins get back to where they were, at 11 and a bit percent, talking sort of $918 million in operating income on a $4.5 billion market cap, that's a PE of around 5. So all of a sudden, this starts looking ridiculously cheap. Okay, so there are some biggish moves put in there, right, to move up the balance sheet, up the income statement a little bit. And the idea that if I were looking here, I wouldn't be worried about revenue stagnating, which was the kind of risk you flagged. I would be saying, look, I'm expecting margins to come back. And therefore, that same revenue will look a lot more like a more attractive number at the in the bottom line on this sort of thing. I had another thing from a kind of investing side of things here, but I'll let Steve say something for a moment.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's essentially 10 times cash flow if they hit their if they hit their projections, which if we think that they evidently had a very large uptick in revenues over the last couple of years, they've essentially doubled. More than doubled. So to say that they're spending all on fulfillment and delivery is something you would expect they had to do. Amazon did the same thing. So if we pretend for now, because it's hard to tell, that HelloFresh potentially have overbuilt and they've got to grow into these new facilities and grow into capacity, sweat the assets, you should start to see free cash flow come through for them. The only issue I've got is the sort of anecdotal evidence is that I actually think Gusto is better. I think the meals are harder to cook. I think I'd probably go with that. But I actually think there's a lot more choice on Gusto. So I would be amazed to see what I haven't actually seen the stats for the market in the UK, but I'd be amazed to see that HelloFresh is roundly beating Gusto out here. But the problem with that is that Gusto, I don't think, makes any money, and I don't think has any sort of proposition of making any money. So it's one of those annoying kind of competitors that you have to wait to go bust.
Yeah, I think one of the great things about HelloFresh is that it can wait for these competitors to go bust. I agree. I feel like I've heard that Gusto is thinking of IPOing, which I would absolutely love to compare. I may be making that up, but I'm sure I've heard that somewhere. I really hope they do, because I would love to compare their financials and see how they are doing. Because I agree that Gusto makes nicer meals. It does have more choice and more complicated to make. And maybe this is just because I've come from HelloFresh. It bugs me that they don't package all the ingredients together per meal and that I have to go hunting around the fridge. Maybe that just shows how lazy HelloFresh has made me. I've gone from shopping at a supermarket to get all my ingredients to crying when they don't come in their own little plastic, their own little paper bags. But I mean, I think that was another thought behind my thesis is convenience may well win out if it can end up being done at a reasonable price.
You are right that it makes you exceptionally lazy, HelloFresh, because you get that bag out and you think to yourself, like, I shouldn't really put rice in the fridge, but I can't be bothered to separate it out of the bag. So you just jam it in. I remember my wife was just putting it, she just like pulled out the bag and had like rice and honey, and she was like, these things shouldn't be in the fridge. It's like, yeah, but I didn't want to open the bag. I trusted that the ingredients were here.
The honey in particular, it's always like, oh, if the honey has gone solid, just leave it in some boiling water for a minute.
Yeah, I had that problem often, as you could tell.
HelloFresh are clever in ways Gusto are not, actually, with their recipe cards. Gusto, one of the things that I've done when they stopped discounting stuff to me, as they do sporadically, I'm as loyal as that, basically. When they're not giving me stuff cheap, I'm not buying it. One of the things I did was start making their recipes, because I thought they were decent-ish recipes. There's some stuff we liked there. We bought ingredients and made them. HelloFresh is much harder to do that, because they, at least on the recipe cards I have, don't actually have quantities on them. They just have pack of this, sachet of that, and don't tell you how much is in that sachet. So they, one of my favorite things from HelloFresh, first thing I got from them, I think, was an aubergine satay. And I don't know how much Thai yellow curry paste to put into it. And I've never managed to get it right since, because they just say sachet of this. And I'm like, I don't know how big the damn sachet is, which is meaning that I basically either have to go back to them and buy that thing or keep getting their boxes in order to get stuff portioned correctly. So there's a stickiness there that there isn't with Gusto. And Steve, go on, say the stickiness thing, Steve.
No, we've got to have a sort of a three-man appreciation here of ketchup manis, because you don't get that from anything else. But honestly, I could put the sachet in my mouth after I squeezed it. It's so tasty.
Yes, the food is sticky as well as the stuff. One last investing thought from me on this. Remember that? You said the most surprising thing was that this company is profitable. That wasn't the most surprising thing to me. The most surprising thing to me about this company was it's doing buybacks. Their share count is coming down over the last couple of years, which that I did not expect to see. I had a look at the share count, mostly thinking, oh, I'll see it's going up quite a lot. And is it growing faster than their revenue? It's not. It's coming down again. So, yeah, it's profitable, but it is also kind of returning cash here, which means it sort of almost qualifies as a candidate stock for Paul, whoever he is. That was interesting to me. And I wonder whether they're reaching inflection point here in terms of kind of growth. You talked about the possibility of revenues getting a bit stuck. And then you're looking for growth from a combination of margin expansion and share count coming down in that case. And you might find it from what I can see of it. But I was interested in seeing that starting. That stood out to me.
Yeah, I think they're, it's slightly stereotypical, but I look at a lot of American companies, and then HelloFresh, a German company, and it just feels like it's run so much more sensibly. Like it just feels to me like a well-run business. I mean, you know, they printed tons of free cash flow. They didn't use it all on their stock-based compensation. They decided to buy back some shares and invest in the business. And okay, fine, this year they will just have negative free cash flow. But the investments that they've made in the business takes their capacity up to where it would need to be in order to make, I think it's 10 billion euros in annual revenue, which is what their target is for 2025. So in theory, they will be able to reach that 2025 revenue target of 10 billion without having to put too much into investing into new infrastructure. So I can see a very feasible way that these margins that they're after come to fruition. Obviously, analysts are 2024, they're expecting whatever it was, 434 million euros in free cash flow. That's very close to the 500 million in 2025. Will that happen? Who knows? But I feel like the company has put itself in a very good position to get to that point.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, anything else on HelloFresh? Or should we, let's wind things up there in that case. One to keep on the radar for the likes of you and me for when we have cash available and we're looking for things to buy and to think seriously about. And if you've enjoyed that 20-minute advert for various delivery boxes, we will pop links to both of those two for Jamie, whichever one you prefer to get him a discount on downstairs. So check below for links to someone's Gusto boxes that are not mine, and also probably a HelloFresh link as well if he's got one to send us. If you buy the stock, do let us know. And if you own the stock, do let us know. But that's about all we've got time for this week. Gosh, it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really good having Jamie on. Jamie, just before we go, where can people find you on the socials?
So Instagram is the best bet. It's at Stocks and Savings. You will see a profile picture of someone who does not look like me. That's my girlfriend, and we run the page together. The reason is because in order to get verified and stop having accounts trying to copy us and scam other people, we can only have one person. So you will see her face, but if you look a little bit lower down, you should see my face somewhere too. That's where you can find us. We do also have a podcast, which is a lot more focused on individual educational things. It's more for people that are still learning to invest. So that's something worth checking out when we come back in September. Check out our Instagram. You'll find most things from there.
Cool. Go check that out. Jamie, thank you so much for being here and joining us. Steve, as always, thank you very much for your time this week. And we will see all of you next week. Bye for now.